And the next matter under oral calendar today, the file number is A221568, State of Minnesota versus Devondre Demont Pike. And welcome, counsel. We are recording this proceeding and also live streaming the proceeding. We do ask, as a result, that when you approach the podium, you identify yourself for the record, whom you represent. A recording of the proceeding will be available audio on the court's website within 24 hours. Typically. So whenever you're ready, counsel for appellant, you may approach and identify yourself and begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I represent the appellant, Devondre Pike. This court must reverse Mr. Pike's conviction because the evidence against him was the fruit of an unlawful arrest. That arrest was unlawful for two independent reasons as articulated in our brief. I'd like to focus on the fact that the arrest was illegal because it was for a misdemeanor. Before I do, I just want to note that my clock hasn't started yet. So I'm not trying to get extra.
You get a bit of
that
an advantage.
Kind of you.
I have a lot to say, but there's a lot of lawyers in the next case. So I don't want to jack up anybody's billable hours.
The key is we all want to know when our clock is ending anyway, right? With this. Can I ask, though, before you do get into the merits, Mr. Butler, I saw that your client did not raise this theory of the issue below, and it's not an in unlimited, or what's the phrase I want to use? It's not a light ask of this court with regard to the basis for what you believe is an illegal arrest in reference to Rule 601, because it's never been directly addressed. But my question, most importantly, is procedurally. Typically, we do not address matters that have not been raised below because it doesn't afford a record the district court's opportunity to address it. And in fact, as I look at the record, it almost looks like it was almost a concession that this is not a violation of 601, because I think the phrase was in the argument to the court that it essentially the shopkeeper statute creates a fourth exception in any event, which I think is part of what respondent argues. But my question is, what basis would we have to review that issue today?
Sure. So I think a couple answers, Your Honor. First, the respondent in this case has not articulated any kind of waiver or forfeiture argument. Nowhere in their brief do they suggest that this issue was not properly preserved. Nowhere in their brief do they suggest that this court should not address the issue. In fact, respondent suggests that this court publish its opinion deciding this issue. So to the extent that waiver and forfeiture doctrines are mostly in place to avoid surprise to the opposing party. And in this case, the opposing party has not expressed any surprise or trouble with the fact that this issue is before the court. And so waiver and forfeiture are generally discretionary doctrines anyway. And given that the respondent hasn't complained about it, I don't know what basis there would be to decline to decide the issue.
Is there a case that so sets forth? It seems the cases where there our court does address it, perhaps because of that point. Mm-hmm. But is there any case that you could point us to that we cannot simply, as a part of our inherent authority and following our own case law, not address it because it wasn't raised below, despite respondent perhaps implicitly or explicitly?
No, I mean, I agree respondent's position doesn't control this court's authority, but I'm only suggesting that. Again, the point of waiver and forfeiture doctrine is not to protect the district court judge. It's to protect the opposing party. Our argument is that Mr. Pike's arrest was illegal under a couple of different theories. Both of those theories are joined by respondent. The facts are undisputed. The question is one of law with de novo review. So even if the district court had been presented more squarely with this question, I'm going to get to how he was presented with it in a second. Even if it had been more squarely presented, this court wouldn't defer to Judge Scoggins' decision anyway, because the question is one of de novo review. And so that's another important part in the cases. And I'm sorry that because respondent hadn't raise this issue. I'm not super prepared to address it, but the cases in which this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have considered issues with fuzzy preservation issues below, that's one of the things the courts look to. Is it a de novo issue with undisputed facts? And in this case, it is. In addition, Judge Scoggin, the reason that defense counsel didn't bang her head against the wall on this issue is that Judge Scoggin said at the end of that omnibus hearing, I don't want to hear about Rule 6 because the shopkeeper statute creates an exception. It was the judge who said something like, well, normally you can't arrest for a misdemeanor under Rule 6, but under this statute, you can. And so the question I'm speaking for the judge, I'm interested in is whether the officer could rely only on the police, I'm sorry, on the loss prevention officer's word to arrest someone if that was good for probable cause. So the judge himself framed the issue and recognized that in his opinion, the statute is the quote unquote exception to the Rule 6 rule. So it wasn't as if the judge wasn't aware that this was a potential problem or a potential conflict. In addition, the prosecutor in his letter memo to the district court cited exactly the argument that respondent is making here, made an argument that Rule 6 is a quote unquote exception to the shopkeeper's arrest rule under this statute 480.059, where the legislature purports to reserve that authority for itself. So again, the opposing party here is not prejudiced by any consideration by this court because it was the opposing party who made the same argument to the district court. If maybe if my client's lawyer had stood up and said, I agree. I am not challenging this. I am not raising Rule 6. I am not doing any of that. It would be different. But I think what she said was something like, well, hang on, we have other arguments, Judge, when he started talking about Rule 6. So she kind of demurred on the matter, but she didn't affirmatively say this arrest was lawful under the rules of criminal procedure. Now let's talk about probable cause. That's not how I read the record anyway. And so given that the state has made no argument that it's prejudiced in any way by this court's consideration of the issue. I think the court's, I'm sorry to make this phrase, but the court's obligation is to decide the dispute between the parties, and the parties have a dispute here.
Jumping then to the merits, and I'm talking about the merits of the shopkeeper statute for lack of a better phrase, because that's what it seems to be known as. Why doesn't the Supreme Court's Childs decision, which was made after the rules of procedure were created. So hence the equivalent, I don't remember the terminology was exactly the same of 601, but in essence, Childs concluded that an arrest pursuant to that statute is proper. Wouldn't that simply end it for us? Because if it's proper, then the search incident to the arrest is proper, assuming we find probable cause or disagree with you on that part of the argument.
Sure. The answer is because this issue wasn't raised in Childs by anyone. No one contended in Childs that Rule 6 trumped the statute. There was no argument about constitutionality or anything else. The only question presented to the Supreme Court in that case was, as you said, Your Honor, was the arrest proper under the statute? The court said it was, and that's the end of the matter. Courts don't reach out and decide issues that aren't presented to them. And so the fact that the Supreme Court did not sua sponte go on to say, oh, and by the way, we're real concerned about a constitutional issue, or we're not concerned about it at all, we're going to raise and then decide a constitutional issue on our own, says nothing. And there are plenty of cases, and again, I'm sorry, I don't have them with me today, where courts say like, well, sure, we said this in another case, but the issue wasn't squarely presented to us. To use Chief Justice Hudson's phrase, we hadn't put our judicial mind to the question of whether the rule and the statute can live together. That quote is from the Hope Coalition case, where the Supreme Court kind of dodges around some of its prior decisions, saying, well, we assumed a couple things in prior decisions about parity motions. But now here we are, the issue's now in front of us, and now we have to decide whether this privilege statute bars what the defendant wants to do. And I would say the same thing is true here. No judicial mind was put to the question in Childs of the issue that's presented to you today, because no one presented it to the court in Childs.
And would you agree in all of the cases that it might be the same answer, where there is a reference to 601, and I think both counsel has cited to the cases, That also was never the specific question that that court, whether it was our court or the Supreme Court, was asked to consider.
I agree. No, I mean, that's why this is a question of first impression. I agree that no court has decided whether how to read Rule 6 and the statute, the shopkeeper statute, together at the same time. So the extent that's your question, Your Honor, I agree with that. And I think it is important to know that they can be read together. This isn't for, in order for Mr. Pike to prevail, you know, this, the rule is a mandatory rule. The officer must, is what it currently says. It used to say shall, now it says must issue a citation for a misdemeanor unless one of three exceptions are in play. None of those exceptions.
It says more than that. It says must issue a citation and release.
Yes.
To me, that means that he's been in custody and the officer then needs to release him.
Yes, Your Honor. He has to.
Is that a way to combine and read the statute and the rule together? You make the arrest, but once you make the arrest, now the rule comes into effect and you have to release and issue a citation.
No, Your Honor, that take into custody or arrest is not the same as stop and issue a citation. And Vernado supports that.
Not my
that.
Question. My question is, can't we read this statute and the rule consistent with each other by saying the statute provides when you can make an arrest. The rule provides what you do after you make the arrest. And that is, if it's a misdemeanor, you must issue a citation and release.
Your Honor, that if the premise of your question then is after you make the arrest, you can search the individual incident to the arrest?
That's not the question.
Okay. My concern is not so much with the word arrest, it's with the search. So Vernado says...
So are you saying that there are some different kinds of arrests that some have attendant to it, the ability to make a search and seizure and some don't?
I'm not, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that under Vernado and under Martin and under this court's decision in Richmond, the officer cannot make an arrest for a misdemeanor pursuant to the rule. The rule, so in order for your hypothetical to work, Your Honor, the rule, to read them quote unquote together, the rule would have to allow an arrest for a misdemeanor. And the rule does not, other than in the three situations that the Supreme Court has set forth.
But moments ago, you said that this is a matter of first impression. So there is no case we can look at to say specifically the arrest here could not be made under Rule 601. There's references or allusions to it, perhaps in a bit of a tangential way. And certainly I appreciate the language you're talking about because it does give that suggestion. And so perhaps counsel for respondent will have a good answer to how that could be squared, but the question's never been asked. So therefore it's never been answered by our court or the Supreme Court.
I'm gonna dispute that a little bit, Your Honor. The question of whether you can make an arrest under Rule 6 has been asked a whole bunch of times. And the answer is always no. And in general, I mean, the Constitution allows police officers to arrest people for any crime, right? So you can always, under the Constitution, you can always arrest for any crime that's at least jailable that would be a misdemeanor. So what the rule does is provide an extra layer of protection to people suspected of committing misdemeanors that's not afforded by the Constitution that says, no, you are correct to say that the rule, that the test between the rule and the statute has not been litigated, and that's why we're here. But I don't think it's true to say that the statute can allow for an arrest that the rule does not allow for. That is a conflict.
Well, that's suggesting that there's something in the rule that prohibits an arrest under certain circumstances. I don't read that anywhere.
That
what I read is that an officer who wants to proceed with a misdemeanor has to issue a citation and release. That's what the rule is directed at, not establishing a basis for an arrest in the first instance. We have all kinds of statutes that provide for that.
Your Honor, I would just direct your attention to Vernado from the Supreme Court and to Richmond from this court, because that is exactly the issue in those cases. The officer arrested someone and searched them and found contraband. On appeal, the claim was the officer was justified in arresting that person because they had probable cause to believe they had committed a misdemeanor. In Vernado, it's a driving offense. I can't remember what it is in Richmond.
In fact, Vernado, wasn't it a petty misdemeanor? Was that the one?
Nope. There is a petty misdemeanor case. It's called Martin from the Supreme Court.
Okay.
Vernado is a misdemeanor driving offense that the Supreme Court notes is punishable by up to 90 days in jail. It's a modern misdemeanor.
Let me ask you this to follow up Judge Klapacki's question, because again, looking at the rule, and this maybe gets to the question of never being head on analyzed specifically by looking at the rule. But first, it is a procedural rule on its face talking about pretrial release. But under 601 subdivision 1A, by arresting officer, well, how can you have an arresting officer if there's not an arrest?
Fair enough. And that's a fair enough play on the language. But I think you have to go back. The rule doesn't exist in a vacuum. And you have to go back and look at the cases that say you cannot arrest for a misdemeanor. I mean, that if the court is going to say that under certain circumstances, the rule allows the under circumstances other than those three that are listed. And I think that's important. But other than those three, you can arrest for a misdemeanor. You should publish that opinion because no one has ever said that before. And it does go against it goes against Vernado and it goes against Richmond and it goes against the other cases that don't allow police to use probable cause for a misdemeanor as a basis to arrest and then search someone incident to arrest. That's the other thing here, is that the courts have been very clear that an arrest in violation of Rule 6 results in suppression of the evidence. The fact that the rule contains three exceptions, I mean, if you just do classic statutory interpretation law, the fact that there are three exceptions sure implies that there isn't a fourth, because it wasn't as if the Supreme Court, when it promulgated the rule, created this general rule and then said, well, we'll figure out the exceptions later. They thought about what exceptions they wanted. They put them in the rule and they didn't include this one.
Supposing the arrest was not based on probable cause, but was based upon in-person offense, that is, the offense was committed in the presence of the officer. What's the applicability of the rule?
I see I'm out of time, Your Honor. Can I respond
yes,
to
you certainly
Judge's
may.
Question? Thank you very much, Judge Klapacki. It doesn't change. All arrests have to be based on probable cause under the Constitution, right? The officer always needs probable cause to believe the person committed a crime.
Well, we have a statute that says specifically an offense committed in the officer's presence.
Correct. For a misdemeanor, there's an extra layer of protection. And that is for most misdemeanors. There's an extra layer of protection that says, even if the officer has probable cause to believe that a person has committed a misdemeanor, you can't arrest for it unless the misdemeanor is committed in the officer's presence. This statute, the shoplifting statute, is designed to create an exception to that rule, the in-person requirement rule. And that's what the Childs case says. This Childs case calls this statute an exception, not to Rule 6, but to the in-person arrest rule. So I agree that just on its face, the statute can allow an arrest for shoplifting not committed in the officer's presence, as long as there's probable cause to believe that the person committed a shoplifting. The problem here is that Rule 6 doesn't allow an arrest for a misdemeanor, period.
Well, that's what we're arguing about.
Well, yes, true. That our position is that Rule 6 doesn't allow an arrest for a misdemeanor, other than in the three situations governed by the rule.
Very well, thank you.
I ask a question?
Yes, you may.
Is it possible to have a felony theft under the shopkeeper statute?
May I answer the question, Your Honor? Thank you. Yes, it is.
And so in this case, prior to arrest, how would the officer know what the level of crime was? Because it seems to me like one of the tensions with your argument is sometimes the police officer might not know until they have done a search what the level of the offense is.
That might be true in some cases, Your Honor. It's not here. The report was that Mr. Pike was stealing pens. And unless there's a pack of pens at Walmart that costs more than $500.
I mean, Sharpies are prohibitively expensive.
They are prohibitively. It wasn't 100 pack of pens, Judge. It was one pack of pens. And so the officer knew that the crime was a misdemeanor. And I think that's why, again, respondent does not make that argument, didn't make that argument to the district court to say that, oh, there really was probable cause to arrest for a felony here. And so we don't have to worry about Rule 6. Respondent has always taken the position that there was probable cause to arrest for a misdemeanor, meaning a misdemeanor theft. But that's allowed under the statute, which in respondent's view, trumps Rule 6.
Doesn't that get back to the reason we have our forfeiture cases is because it was not asked to be responded to. In other words, again, that was not the basis of the suppression. It was simply probable cause, lack of probable cause.
It was responded to, though, because again, respondent at the district court level made an argument. And their argument was, this was an arrest for a misdemeanor, which is lawful under the statute, and the statute is an exception to Rule 6. That was their argument at the district court level. That is their argument here. Maybe more importantly, that's their argument here. And so there is no, there is a case or controversy in front of you in which the parties have adequately briefed a question of de novo review. And I'm sure Mr. Petras will stand up in a second because he's a good lawyer and try to get on this forfeiture bandwagon that Your Honor has suggested. But he didn't do it in his brief. And I think there's a reason for that. And the reason for that is because the case was thoroughly briefed, presented to the district court, presented to this court. You don't want to publish an opinion deciding it? That's fine. You want to issue an order opinion deciding it? That's fine. But I would ask the court to simply resolve the dispute between the parties.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask one other question?
May. And implied by my approval is you can answer it as well.
Okay, thank you. Glad we'd cut out that. I'm sorry, Your Honor, go ahead.
I think that this is my issue is because the question is one of de novo review and not about the facts in this particular case is how do we resolve the issue of, you know, I think part of why the shopkeeping statute might exist is that you don't really know what's stolen until you've had a search. And so how do we resolve the fact that there may be some cases where the arrest in this, right, if this had been five Apple Watches,
right,
that there might not have been a problem with the arrest under the rules with the shopkeeping statute, but the arrest might have been appropriate. And it's not until you've actually done the arrest and done the search that you know whether you are issuing a citation in this case or whether you're talking about a felony offense.
Yeah, I think there's two answers to that. First of all, the fact that it's de novo review doesn't mean you ignore what the facts are. So the facts of the particular case. I mean, whether an arrest is lawful is always based on the facts of a particular case.
But would the arrest have been unlawful if the officer was saying, I'm doing the arrest because I need to figure out whether this is a felony or misdemeanor level offense?
If the officer had probable cause to believe the defendant committed a felony arrest, then the arrest, I'm sorry, committed a felony offense. So if loss prevention had come to the officer and said he stole five Apple Watches, then the arrest might be lawful because there's probable cause to believe the defendant committed a felony. That's not the information the officer here had. The officer had information as to what was stolen, and it was not $500 worth of merchandise. And so whether that, you take the facts, here are the facts. The loss prevention officer told the police officer X, that guy is stealing pens and didn't pay for it. Do those facts that the officer knows create probable cause to believe a theft was committed? That's issue two, which we haven't gotten to yet today. But even if they did, are those facts create a lawful arrest under Rule 6 is a legal question that this court needs to decide because that's the issue presented by the parties. But it's those facts, Your Honor, not just some vague set of facts out. And you can say under these facts, the arrest was unlawful because it was for a misdemeanor and neither of the three things. If Mr. Pike had if the officer knew that Mr. Pike had 18 bench warrants or something, that would create a risk that he wouldn't show up for court, then obviously we wouldn't be here because there'd be one of the three exceptions, but they don't. And so under these facts, the arrest was unlawful and the evidence has to be suppressed.
Very well, thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes.
Thank you.
For rebuttal. And counsel for respondent, when you're ready to join the bandwagon, you can approach the podium, identify yourself, and then begin.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Officer Merseth arrested appellant for shoplifting items from Walmart, and a state statute expressly authorized him to do so. Appellant's argument effectively asked this court to strike down both a provision of the shoplifting arrest statute, as well as Minnesota Statute Section 480.059 Subdivision 7, Clause 6, as unconstitutional because of this rule of criminal procedure 6.01 Subdivision 1, Clause A. And that rule is not a basis upon which this court should strike down those statutes as unconstitutional. I do want to pick up where I believe questions from all three members of this panel kind of led, which is the plain language of Rule 6.01, Subdivision 1, Clause A. As was pointed out, I believe, by Judge Sleater, it begins with the title, by arresting officer. The very first sentence of Clause A then says, in misdemeanor cases, peace officers who decide to proceed with prosecution. And then later, after those three different conditions are laid out, the next sentence reads, if the officer has already arrested the person, all in the plain language of the rule itself. Together, when you read those together, 601 clearly can apply and it's contemplated to apply after a person has been arrested. There's no other way to interpret the language of that rule.
Counsel, now, even if we agree with you on the plain language, at the end of the day, we're an error correcting court. And I do think appellant is correct that there has been some language from our Supreme Court that might direct us to a different interpretation of the rule given statements that an arrest for a misdemeanor under Rule 601 was illegal in Martin. How do we wrestle with the statements that the Supreme Court has made along with your plain language interpretation of the rule?
Because other than in Childs, the only time that the Supreme Court has addressed the shoplifting arrest statute, 629.366, it has held that it justifies the arrest in these circumstances. And on page 16 of my brief in footnote 14, I address Vernado, Martin, and Richmond from this court, because none of those three cases had a specific statute that authorized exactly what happened. The only basis for the custodial arrest in those cases could have been Rule 6.01, because they were not a shoplifting situation in which 629.366 would apply. So those three cases, with all due respect, do not control the situation. This court's decision should be controlled by Childs.
But they're, I mean, controlled by Childs because the court said the statute was legal. But I mean, you don't disagree with appellant that this issue of the conflict was not raised in Childs between 601 and the shoplifting
statute. I agree that it was not raised in Childs. It was directly addressed and raised. It was raised and then directly addressed by this court in a non-precedential opinion in Roning, R-O-N-N-I-N-G, which I cite in my brief. It is directly on point. I understand it's non-precedential. It does not necessarily control this court's decision, but I would deter strongly this court from issuing a decision that directly conflicts with other ones it has issued. And if anything, this court should, as Mr. Butler pointed out, consider issuing a precedential decision here to publish or and to make controlling.
What's the syllabus point going to look like? What will the syllabus point look like that you recommend?
That the shoplifting arrest statute under subdivision 2 of 629.366 authorizes a law enforcement officer to arrest a person within this reasonable cause or probable cause that they've committed shoplifting. Essentially, what the plain language of subdivision 2 of that statute says.
Isn't the point, though, it sounds like you're agreeing we should address it, though it wasn't raised below, and that is how your brief looks. But isn't the new issue, because Childs already said that it would be a reference to 601. If I understand the point, you have competing reasons. But
take a little bit further, it should talk about that 601. I believe Judge Klopapping's questions kind of began this focus, but it would apply after an arrest has been made, because exactly to Judge Larson's point before, it could have been.
So a lawful arrest has not become unlawful by reason of Rule 601 is what you're really saying.
If the case continues to be a misdemeanor, yes. Which going to Judge Larson's point before, we don't know if it's going to be a misdemeanor or not, really, until the search exists. And one of the points, touching on another thing that Judge Larson said, one of the points of the shoplifting arrest statute is so that the items that are taken from the place of business are returned right then and there. And it's not the idea is that the business itself has their merchandise being taken unlawfully. And what matters most to that business is just getting the Apple Watches, getting the Sharpie markers, getting whatever the merchandise happens to be back so they can be put back on the shelves and they continue to function. I think that the difference between a misdemeanor or a gross misdemeanor and a felony is not really known and cannot be known with precision by watching the surveillance video. You can have reasonable or probable cause that an individual is taking things from a store like they did in this case. But is it just three iPods that's a little bit less than the $1,000 threshold for a felony offense? Is it four AirPods? And you don't necessarily know that until the search happens. So you can see that somebody is taking AirPods, you know, from a store, and then you're stopping them after they move past that last point of purchase. But until the search takes place and you find what's actually on their person, it's not clear if it's a misdemeanor case, like Rule 6.01 contemplates, a gross misdemeanor case, or a felony case, which is why 6.01 applies when it does after the arrest and the search that's authorized by that statute.
Mr. Petras, then, and maybe this goes to your last statement, how far after the arrest? I guess what I understand you to have argued in your brief and saying today, and as part of a syllabus point, is you believe that a rule of criminal procedure 601 is substantively relevant to an arrest that happens long before there's any charge and whether that less arrest is legal or not. In other words, you're agreeing with appellant's counsel that when officers are trained and whether to arrest someone, they should look to Rule 601. And so hence that makes it a substantive issue that we need to address when dealing with a pre-charge, pre-trial argument of whether arrest was legal or not, hence the search is legal or not.
I want to clarify what I just said, because I want to make sure that you're understanding my position at least, which is that looking at that first sentence again of Rule 6.01, Subdivision 1, Clause A, in misdemeanor cases, peace officers who decide to proceed with prosecution. So as that is the threshold inquiry or application of that provision, a peace officer has to have an idea of what that case is about. They have to know the amount of theft that has occurred, whether that's at a misdemeanor threshold, a gross misdemeanor threshold, or a felony threshold. And to decide to proceed with prosecution means that case, practically speaking, is being tab charged, the citation is being e-filed, it's being referred to a prosecutor's office like my own to review for potential felony charges, if it's a felony case that requires a complaint. So I believe that 6.01 has a role, obviously, in the system. But I think that role is once it's clear whether or not we're dealing with a misdemeanor case or a felony case, and that is not going to be known at the moment that the person is stopped and arrested for shoplifting as 629.33 authorizes.
Maybe another way of asking my question, does the role of 601 only begin once there's a determination of the level of offense, meaning that's the discussion we've been having, felony versus misdemeanor, such that the issue directly before us might not require us to look at Rule 601 because we know here there's a felony and there was arrest pursuant to a statute that allowed the search.
Precisely. I think there may be a common belief or understanding that when a person is arrested, it means the person is taken from where law enforcement found them, and they are physically brought, likely in the backseat of a squad car, to a police station, to a jail. They're formally booked, photographed, fingerprint, processed into that jail. But that is plainly inconsistent with the language of 6.01. So I think in this particular case, you know, after the arrest happened and the amount of methamphetamine was found on appellant's person, it became a felony case. And by the language, that opening sentence of Rule 6.01, Subdivision 1, Clause A, I don't see how that could apply anymore once the discovery of methamphetamine has been made. And it's obviously a felony case and not an in misdemeanor case.
So counsel, I here's what I'm wrestling with is if in Martin, in that series of cases, the Supreme Court has said that an arrest for a misdemeanor is illegal under Rule 601.
And unless one of those three conditions.
Yeah. Yeah. Exists. And we're stuck with that as the Court of Appeals. And then we have the shoplifting statute. It does seem to me that we then have to resolve the sort of separation of powers question about the case law that says when it's a rule of procedure, then the rules control. Whereas if it's not a rule of procedure, then the legislature has the ability to legislate in that area. And so I guess my question for you is if we feel that, you know, Martin binds us to say that the arrest is illegal, How do we wrestle with that sort of separation of powers question?
The only way for you to agree with appellant's position in the context of the question just asked Judge Larson is to find Minnesota Statute 480.059, Subdivision 7, Clause 6, unconstitutional. Because that's what specifically allows them, because that includes the shoplifting arrest statute as one that remains in, quote, full force and effect, regardless or notwithstanding any rule that's promulgated by the Supreme Court. And so that is why the shoplifting arrest statute, as this court found or held in Roning, why that is an exception to Rule 6.01 in that sense. So if this court were to say that the shoplifting arrest statute, because it authorizes an arrest for, you know, a misdemeanor shoplifting offense, is inconsistent with Martin or Richmond or Vernado, which did not involve the shoplifting arrest statute, then it would have to find essentially that provision of the shoplifting arrest statute, subdivision 2, which can apply to misdemeanors, as well as specifically 480.059, unconstitutional. And I would urge this court to not do that.
But aren't we sort of, I mean, making all of the assumptions all the way up and not going to repeat them all, but aren't we sort of stuck in that position because the Supreme Court has said they have the inherent authority to create the rules. And so the legislature, the 420 statute, the legislature doesn't really have the authority to tell the Supreme Court that it's reserving those things. If we think that this is in fact a procedural rule as opposed to a substantive rule.
I understand that point. I don't necessarily think this is a procedural the way that that distinction has been drawn out, like purely procedural in terms of substantive and procedural. I think I make that point in my brief, but usually procedural goes to determining the guilt or innocence of someone. For instance, in Johnson, which is a 1994 case, cited, I believe, in both parties' briefs. I believe appellant pays a fair emphasis on it in both of his briefs. That involved certifying a misdemeanor as a petty misdemeanor. And that's very much in the, you know, determining your guilt or innocence, because that affects whether or not you can have a jury as being your fact finder, or whether you're stuck with a judge, or, you know, I don't want to delve into the merits of a bench trial or jury trial before this panel, but I think you understand what I'm saying. And I think that Johnson in particular, if you look at the facts there, that was actually a rule, excuse me, a statute, I think it was like 609.131, that was enacted after the rules of criminal procedure were promulgated in the mid-1970s. So in that particular case, it's very much more purely procedural. And it's also one that came after, I mean, it was quite obvious that the Supreme Court was going to be promulgating rules that address that area. Whereas in this case, the shoplifting arrest statute predated the promulgation of the rules of criminal procedure, which I think is an important distinction. And I think the reason that some of the case law, whether that be Johnson or Olson or Willis or Azure or Lindsay or Drew, which Drew is the one that appellant places emphasis on in his reply brief, none of those involved 629.366, the shoplifting arrest statute, which again, going into 480.059, that is one that is specifically, you know, exempted from being preempted. And if you look at some of the other provisions, like say the provision that was at issue in Johnson, which is subdivision one or subdivision seven clause one, that required specifically that the, let's see, I have the language right in front of me, statutes which relate to substantive criminal law. And so that's why there's that distinction or emphasis between substantive and procedural that's drawn out in Johnson. And Johnson approvingly cited 480.059 subdivision seven. And that's why they went through that substantive versus procedural distinction. May I finish my answer?
Yes, Justice, you sure may.
Whereas if you jump down to clause six of that subdivision, it doesn't make that limitation at all with respect to 629.336, the shoplifting arrest statute. It doesn't matter if it's substantive, doesn't matter if it's procedural, it simply matters that it exists. It has been, I mean, again, as Judge Sleater pointed out in his earlier question, Rule 601 wasn't raised in Childs, but Childs is issued after that court had promulgated Rule 6.01. And so it was very aware of the landscape when it did so. I'm happy to entertain any other questions. I realize that I'm out of time.
Appears to be none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you will now have 5 minutes to rebuttal, and you may approach and proceed.
Thank you. couple of things. There are two potential sources of authority to arrest. Today, for the first time, it has been suggested that Rule 6 allows a police officer to arrest for a misdemeanor. That is 100% contrary to Varnado. As Judge Larson said, we're all stuck with what the Supreme Court said. And what the Supreme Court said is that in that case, the claim was the officer had, let me back up for a second. Varnado was a lot like this case. There is an encounter between law enforcement and the suspect. There is a search. There is the recovery of drugs. Varnado is charged with a felony because of the recovery of drugs, just like Mr. Pike was. The state in Varnado said, well, that search was okay because the officer had probable cause to arrest Varnado for a misdemeanor offense of failure to have a driver's license in her possession. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said no, because the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure permit a custodial arrest for misdemeanors only under certain circumstances. Those are the three we've talked about. And they go on to say that the record is absent of facts supporting any of those three. And they go on to say there be no valid basis for a custodial arrest at the time the policeman initiated the frisk. In this case, the frisk was not proper as a search incident to arrest, citing Martin. That is exactly what happened here. So Rule 6 does not authorize this arrest. So then we get to the statute.
Regardless of the plain language.
Regardless of the plain language, because we are not writing on a blank slate when it comes to Rule 6. The Supreme Court and this court, I mean, I could quote this court's cases saying the same thing, Richmond being the biggest one, that Rule 6 doesn't authorize an arrest for a misdemeanor. The statute obviously does. So then we get to Judge Larson's point about conflict. And I will just say that in order for the state to prevail here, this court will have to find that Rule 6 is unconstitutional as applied to this situation. Because Rule 6 is according to the state's position, is that Rule 6 is unconstitutional when compared to this statute. And if Rule 6 was a quote unquote substantive rule, that would have effect. It is not. The definition of a substantive rule, and this comes from Drew, which is this court's definition, is a rule that defines a crime, prescribes punishment, or deprives a defendant of the defense on the merits. That is not Rule 6. A statute is procedural, according to the Minnesota Supreme Court in Johnson at page 555, when it neither creates a new cause of action nor deprives the defendant of a defense on the merits. That's a procedural statute. This statute is a procedural statute. The fact that it involves police officers doesn't make it substantive any more than the Scales rule is substantive. In Scales, the Minnesota...
So here's my question about Scales. Yeah. Doesn't Scales really become a procedural rule because it's saying what evidence can be presented at trial, as opposed to saying if a police officer interrogates in this way, it's illegal? That's my question.
I thought of that, Your Honor, so I pulled up Scales. Okay. Good question. Scales does two things. So what they say is, in the exercise of our supervisory power to ensure the fair administration of justice, we hold that all custodial interrogation, including any information about rights, blah, 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 and questioning, shall be electronically recorded where feasible. That's the rule. And then it says, if you don't follow our rule, we're not going to let the evidence in. And that's the remedy. And so later in Scales at page 593.
So for example, if you had an admission, I put the gun in X place and then the police officers use that and it's not recorded.
Right.
And they use that information to find the gun.
Right.
I don't think that the gun would be excluded even though they discovered it because of a confession that was not recorded, even though you may not get the confession in at trial.
I am not familiar with the fruits of a Scales violation case law off the top of my head, Your Honor. What I will say is that the Minnesota Supreme Court itself described that first thing as a rule. What it says is the rule and the remedy will apply prospectively from the date of the filing of this opinion. So there's a rule, and then there's a remedy for a violation of the rule. And that's the same thing here. I mean, Rule 6 has limited what police officers can do since 1975.
Mr. Butler,
since 1975, there's been no case that says the police officers can arrest for a misdemeanor in any situation other than those three. Yes, Your Honor.
Can I focus on the fact that if you concede it's procedural is it not possible that they are not, the statute, shopkeeper statute and the rule are not in conflict because it is procedural and we look to the statute? And that's hence why we haven't had a direct head resolution of this issue, because again, the statute is a substantive law. And of course, the Constitution is the basis upon which we look for a proper arrest.
I assume I can answer your question, Your Honor. No, and I think Your Honor, with all due respect, might have it a little backwards. So the legislature can create procedural statutes, no problem. They have the authority to do that. But the courts are clear that where a procedural rule conflicts with a procedural statute, the rule controls.
But my question is, why is not the statute that we're dealing with substantive?
Oh, the statute's not substantive. Look to Drew. A statute is substantive when it defines a crime, prescribes punishment, or deprives a defendant of a defense on the merits. That is Drew's definition of a substantive statute. This statute does not do any of those things. Doesn't define a crime, doesn't prescribe punishment, doesn't deprive a defendant of a defense on the merits. If it's not substantive, it's procedural.
The rules that we have for bail, are those procedural rules?
Yeah, yes, probably. The Minnesota Supreme Court has procedural authority. They create the rules of criminal procedure. This is one of them. And maybe they can create a substantive rule. They can not a I don't know that they can create a substantive non-constitutional rule. They can certainly interpret the Constitution to provide some rule, but they can only create procedural rules. And the procedural rule, so that's the problem, I think, with respondents' argument, is that he'd be asking you to say that this rule is either substantive and therefore unconstitutional, or that somehow in this battle between a procedural rule and a procedural statute, somehow the statute trumps because the legislature says the statute trumps. And I think, as Judge Larson pointed out to counsel, that doesn't fly. And Johnson makes that very clear, that the Supreme Court doesn't care what the legislature thinks it's reserving for itself when we're talking about procedural authority to do procedural things, because that authority is the Supreme Court's, not the legislature's.
I haven't read the Ronning case recently. Can you tell me what the holding of that case was?
I think counsel has accurately described the holding in that case. It is an unpublished case. It is not precedential, and I'd encourage you.
I understand all of that. I'd like to know what the holding is.
I think the holding, I haven't read it recently either, Your Honor, because it was not precedential, so it wasn't in my brain. I think the holding is that the line is something like, this statute creates an exception to Rule 6. I think the word exception is in there somewhere. And so I think that's true. I think that is what this court said. That is certainly what the district court in this case said this statute creates an exception to Rule 6. Appellant before you says none of that's true. Respondent says it is. The case is yours. We respectfully request that you reverse appellant's conviction.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've probably exhausted the discussion we can have today. We'll take the matter under advisement. We appreciate your answers to our questions today in the briefing, and we'll issue an order within 90 days.
Thank you, Brian.
Have a good day.